This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show with somebody who's pretty familiar to the state, especially to those folks who have visited Medora in recent years, because it's Joe Wiegand Day here at Prairie Public. Joe is in studio with us here in Fargo. Joe is a Theodore Roosevelt repriser. Thanks for being with us, Joe.
It's a real delight to be with you, Doug Hamilton, and with your listeners on Prairie Public Radio on Main Street.
Let's get a little background of you, Joe. You grew up in Illinois? In
suburban Chicago, the land of Lincoln, and I can remember as a little boy watching a man come to my elementary school pretending to be Abraham Lincoln. So in this state where Clay Jenkinson does such a wonderful job of bringing to life Thomas Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt and others, this tradition of first-person reprisals or interpretation or reenactment, it's a delight to be a part of doing that, especially at Theodore Roosevelt National Park and for Medora.
Now, let's discuss this word repriser. How do you define that?
Caught me on that, didn't you? Well,
yeah.
It's sort of like Q-tip or Kleenex, Doug. Uh-huh. I've come up with my own phrase. For reenactor, if you think about that and have a picture in your mind, and your listeners do, very often you might think of the Civil War reenactors, the folks who camp out and they really have to have an 1863 button because you couldn't have an 1864 button and be at Gettysburg. They do wonderful work to keep history alive. I found the phrase in the Constitution in the first article in the enumerated powers of Congress. Congress has the authorization and the power to issue letters of marque and reprisal, during which Congress authorizes a pirate ship to capture an enemy ship and present it in exchange for reward. Uh-huh. So what I'm trying to do is capture the spirit and essence of Theodore Roosevelt and present it, and thank goodness I often do so in exchange for reward.
How did you begin your career as a Theodore Roosevelt repriser?
You are not going to see this one coming. I sit before you the son of a hippie comedian.
Uh-huh.
My father was Jim Wiggins, the last hippie in America, and moved the family from Chicago to Hollywood in the 70s. My dad had long hair and an earring and a headband, and the only way to be a rebellious teenager was to volunteer for Ronald Reagan's campaign and join the NRA and the Christian Coalition. So I graduated high school, the first in my family to do so. My mom and dad started a family young and didn't complete high school. I went on to college at the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee, political science. I got involved in politics and public policy. My mentor was Congressman Phil Crane, a PhD in history, and we could use a few more of those, I think, in the halls of Congress. And I was involved for 25 years in Illinois Republican politics. I fought my own Republican Party leadership, and Doug, as you might know, the federal prosecutor eventually proved the Illinois Republican Party was just as corrupt as the Chicago Democrats. They were just cheaper to buy. But I would go to Lincoln Day dinners, and if your audience members have been to Lincoln Day dinners or Jefferson Jackson dinners or Chamber of Commerce dinners, all too often the banquet runs long, you write a check, you get a bad piece of chicken, and you hear a speech by a member of Congress that makes the chicken look pretty good by comparison. I began doing comedic characters. Father Giuseppe Republicano was just a ripoff of Guido Sarducci.
Yes.
But then my sister-in-law, a very insightful lady, and she'd known me for 20 years by that time, she said, "I know you love the idea of public service and of helping this country, but what if your public service took a different form than elected office and public service?" And I was also a campaign professional managing presidential and gubernatorial campaigns in Illinois. And so she gave me the book, The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt, that wonderful Pulitzer Prize winner by Edmund Morris, told the story of young T.D. overcoming his asthma. I was a bronchial boy before I built my body and became an ultramarathoner. Now I say I built my body and I seem to have overdone it a bit. But that book gave me the idea of bringing Theodore Roosevelt to life. My wife of 32 years will tell you I grew into the role, the mustache and glasses and a bit of paunch, but still an athletic history. And so I began to perform as Theodore Roosevelt roughly in about 2004, been doing it 15 years. In 2008, in celebration of Teddy's 150th birthday, my wife, daughter, and dog got in an RV. We toured all 50 states, performed at the White House, and I never looked back on that political career. I decided that it would be a higher service to the country to bring TR to life. I do so in wonderful one-person theater shows, the way Clay does his characters. But I also spend a great deal of time in the schools of this country and very often just donate those school performances, because I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing if it weren't for some great public school teachers along the way, especially from Elmhurst, Illinois.
You mentioned Clay Jenkinson, of course, does the Thomas Jefferson Hour on public radio and on our air as well. Clay is a scholar of Thomas Jefferson, a scholar of history and,
right.
and of the humanities. How deeply do you delve into TR?
Well, what's a really wonderful thing that I am able to indulge in is I simply do Theodore Roosevelt. I think Clay is such a Renaissance man, and his brain is so tremendously inspired and active that I think he has this desire and need, and he fulfills it so wonderfully, to do multiple characters. Well, of course, Theodore Roosevelt himself had sort of that multiple character or multiple facet to his personality. So there's the playful president who the British ambassador, Lord Bryce, said that when dealing with the American president, one must remember that he's about six. And yet the readingist and the writingist president wrote 30 books. But as I say, with regards to his prose, he said the first chapters of his first book, The Naval History of the War of 1812, read as dryly as a dictionary. I do say that I would say your English professor would say I was quite abusive of the semicolon. You know, it's ponderous sometimes what he wrote, but it's such a delight to bring Theodore Roosevelt to life.
And when did you start performing at Medora?
This will be my eighth summer. 2012 was my first summer. I had the chance to visit a couple of times as I traveled the country to do research. Randy Hutzenbuehler, the president, I often say the real president in Medora, he and I have been friends since that time, and we're just delighted to have the chance to work together. And looking forward to my eighth summer, and hope that some of your listeners will come out and ask for Teddy.
Well, I went online to teddyrooseveltshow.com, which is your website.
Yes, sir.
And called up the tour schedule, and you are on the road a lot.
What I often say, Doug, is that when the pace is Rooseveltian, it's easy to stay in character. Mm-hmm. Whether it was from my own experience of being a candidate or a campaign manager, if I wasn't or if my candidate wasn't greeting voters and making speeches from 7 a.m. until 10 p.m., you weren't working hard enough. And when you look at Theodore Roosevelt's schedule, the number of speeches that he would make on the 1903 tour that brought him back to Medora in the 1912 election campaign, those were days of 6, 7, 8 speeches a day.
Wow.
So when I've got that evening show, I tell the schools, bring me into the school. The most disruptive thing you can do at a school is have an all-school assembly. I say, put me in your library or your auditorium at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'll stay, and every regular class hour, you bring the history students or the theater students appropriate for that hour, spend the whole day at the schools. So in a typical day, I might do 6 or 7 or 8 performances, but I'm Teddy Roosevelt, and I've got black coffee. What more do I need? I got great material and caffeine.
And you've been working around the state just this past week, as a matter of fact, East Grand Forks, Fargo, going off to Oaks and Bismarck and Williston. So
right. And we'll be in your listening area down in Sioux Falls and even out in Sydney, Montana, and Miles City, Montana, I'll finish up, because, of course, your broadcast is carried throughout a 3 or 4 state region. But we do that every spring just to kind of remind people that summer's coming. And after the crops are in the ground and they're sprayed and you got a little downtime after you're done working on the tractor, come on out and enjoy another Medora musical. But increasingly, we're seeing people from throughout the country and throughout the world come to visit Theodore Roosevelt National Park.
And as you visit the state this year, there's brand new news from the legislature about the Theodore Roosevelt Library being approved and in the Medora Park area. Is going to be a reality up here.
I want to say hooray and congratulations to the people of North Dakota and the people of the country. And, Doug, I would say that even if I was a Calvin Coolidge repriser. I've been to all of the other presidential museums. The draw that we're going to be, especially from the 4.2 million annual visitors to Yellowstone, that Roosevelt Arch at Gardner, Montana is 6 hours away. Mount Rushmore, where I say I'm rather stone-faced, that's 4 hours down 85, the Theodore Roosevelt International Expressway. We're going to be drawing those tour buses now to come to Medora. We haven't had the critical mass with the musical in the park, but if we do, and I you know, the only thing waiting now is the fundraising and the construction and the ribbon cutting. When we build that museum, they will come. 1.4 million of those Yellowstone visitors are off-season, fall through spring. We'll be year-round in Medora, and that museum will allow us to grow into that year-round capacity.
And it's a unique location because Theodore Roosevelt sort of invented the national park system, didn't he?
He did in a way, but I say this is one place where I will be out of characteristically humble. Yellowstone, 1872, President Ulysses S. Grant. I say it took an act of Congress to name a national park. On this issue of the conservation of our natural resources, the original was a progressive, and he discovered that very often the opposite of progress was Congress, that it was Speaker Joe Cannon who famously said, not one red cent for scenery. So even the creation of the National Park Service, 1916, that's Woodrow Wilson, about the only thing that fellow got right. But the people believe that Theodore Roosevelt had the parks in his heart, and he had them from the time of founding Boone and Crockett in 1887 to the time when post-presidency he was still advocating for more national parks for this country and national forests and et cetera.
Well, during the debate in the North Dakota House, it was argued that, well, Theodore Roosevelt was from New York. He spent, you know, a year and a half or so in North Dakota, and he talked like a New Yorker, so why shouldn't the library be there?
Of course, you know and your listeners know that in Fargo in 1910, Theodore Roosevelt said he would have never been president but for his experiences in North Dakota. And as president in the White House, he told a colleague, if you took away every memory from my lifetime and vouchsafed me but one, the one that I would choose to retain would be of my time as a cattle rancher along the Little Missouri, and that it indeed was the place where the romance of his life began. There's a lot going on in New York. A presidential library would almost be lost, I think, in the great Gotham. Here is where Theodore Roosevelt healed from that terrible loss of his wife and mother. Came up a cropper as a cattle rancher, but he wasn't the only one to be decimated by that terrible blue winter of 86-87. But he healed and decided to get back in the family way, to re-enter the political realm. Theodore Roosevelt would not have been president but for his experiences in North Dakota, and I think that's something that we can embrace and celebrate.
Why is it that he is so popular with audiences, do you think?
There's that energy and the playfulness. There's the accomplishment. There's the action. There's a wonderful wit and humor. There's also the other characters in the family. Six children, most of them small. Young Quentin, the head of the White House gang. Princess Alice with a snake in her person, smoking cigarettes on the White House roof. But he's got a little bit of something for everyone. On the left, if we say there's a left and a right divide in this country, Theodore Roosevelt may indeed be the unifying factor. The left loves the trust busting and the business regulation and the environmental record. The right loves the Panama Canal and the Great White Fleet, the lifetime member of the NRA and the great sportsman and explorer in Africa and South America. There's a little something for everybody in Theodore Roosevelt.
You mentioned Quentin Roosevelt, who was killed in World War I, and you led a group over to France last year, right?
Thank you so very much. I can't say that I led it because there were some North Dakotans that played such an important role. Quentin Roosevelt, when he died on July 14th, 1918, that's Bastille Day in France. Mm. He was buried in the little hillside by the local village by the Department of the Aisne. And his gravesite, when the Allies won the ground, became a pilgrimage point for the Allies. July 14th, 2018, that little French village, Collonges-Cohan, where there's a wonderful fountain memorial for Quentin, his body being moved to Normandy to be by Ted Jr.'s side after World War II, they changed the name of their local elementary school from the École Primaire to the École Quentin Roosevelt. Oh. Had Quentin returned from his mission, his commanding officer had him in charge of playing music or records for the local French citizenry for their celebration of Bastille Day. Because Quentin wasn't able to play for the French, we came and played for Quentin. Tom Brousseau, a native of Grand Forks, a graduate of Red River High School, a fellow who's done really well on public radio's Tiny Desk Concert. Tom was the lead of our band. We brought two other musicians and singers. We sang Drink to Me Only with Thine Eyes in French. The French people fell in love with, especially a young man, a recent graduate, a summa cum laude history graduate from University of North Dakota, Austin Arts of Minot. Austin portrayed Quentin Roosevelt and the bond of friendship and love and bonhomme that was established in that trip is something that I think we're going to continue to nurture.
Joe Wiegand is a Theodore Roosevelt repriser. He's very popular at Medora, and of course he'll be appearing there all this summer into the fall with the Medora musical and his own show. And we'll be back with Joe in just a moment.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Greetings, friends. I am Theodore Roosevelt. I have been gone 100 years. But I think it's just bully that I will be able to pop in once a week on this grand Dakota Datebook series to share some of my thoughts. As you know, I have a special place in my heart for North Dakota, and I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you again. In all modesty, I had a great deal to say on many topics, and I earnestly hope you will find some value in my insights and ideas. So join me once a week on Dakota Datebook and sign up for the, what do you call it? Oh, yes, podcast.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. You just heard Steve Stark do his version of Theodore Roosevelt. We're in studio with Joe Wiegand. He is a Theodore Roosevelt repriser who's well known to people who go to the Medora musical and take in that tourist attraction in western North Dakota during the season. And the season is coming up, Joe.
May 31st is the opening of the Medora musical. That's a Friday night. June 1st, I'll begin my Theodore Roosevelt salute to Medora on the Bill Sorensen stage at the Old Town Hall Theater. This will be Bill Sorensen's final year of co-hosting the Medora musical. He's been performing every summer in Medora since 1976, and we're thrilled that he's back again. It's a delight to be there, and a delight to hear Steve Stark, one of my dear friends. Marty Jonason is another man from the Red River Valley who has done Theodore Roosevelt and done some wonderful theater work. Every third weekend in July, we host what we now call the Badlands Chautauqua, a gathering of Theodore Roosevelts, and we have Roosevelts from all over the country, reenactors, reprisers that come. We spend a weekend, and here's a special treat. That third weekend in July, my Saturday and Sunday, 3:30 Mountain Time matinee, will be replaced by a two-man show. My friend Lee Stetson is the nation's leading John Muir. He's in Yosemite every summer.
Speaking of parks.
And where those two men, Roosevelt and Muir, climbed and camped and tramped for 3 days and nights in 1903, Lee Stetson wrote a play called The Tramp and the Rough Rider, and that play will be seen on the Old Town Hall Theater, Bill Sorensen stage, on the third weekend of July. And Lee tells me, he says, Joe, you know what's nice about being doing a two-man show instead of a one-man show? I said, I don't know, Lee, what? He said, it doubles the size of the cast party.
All right. Well, let's talk about this person whose actual voice has been recorded. We can see him on film.
Right.
Lots of photographs of him. Mm-hmm. So how deeply do you go into the impersonation of the actual human?
And add to the wonderful resource material that we have, as you remember, letter writing and diarists at that time. They were so very descriptive about what someone looked like, what they sounded like. So very often, some of my important information comes from his contemporaries who wrote about him. But the film helps, and the gesticulations, the voice, those wonderful Edison recordings from 1913. But of course, he's reading speeches from his 1912 campaign. He's doing so with what I would call is his indoor voice. I'm picturing him reading into one of those megaphones that goes down on the recording cylinder. That outdoor oration voice, as Marty Jonason reminds our new Teddy Roosevelts that we mint out in Medora, you got to throw your voice off the back of the auditorium
wall. There weren't
wall.
Microphones back then.
No microphones. They came into vogue just after the 1912 campaign. So I do avail myself of all of those wonderful different sources. I just happen to be 5'8", 220, mustache, glasses. And so I've actually had the opportunity as well to do some non-theatrical work. I served as the body model for the new statue of Theodore Roosevelt at the American Museum of Natural History. There's the equestrian statue outside. Inside now is a statue of Teddy and what I call his trampabouts. And you can sit down on the bench next to Teddy Roosevelt. Of course, his nose is rubbed quite shiny now, but people put headphones on or put a little a New York Mets cap on the president and have fun with him. And that brings out that little playfulness.
And that's Joe Wiegand as TR there. Huh? Well, let's talk about the family because, of course, they're descendants of Theodore Roosevelt, still among us.
That's right.
Do you have any contact with them?
A wonderful contact. It was a family. You know, Theodore Roosevelt said every American man or woman healthy enough to do so and married should have at least four children. He had six children. Quentin died before being married and didn't have any children. Daughter Alice, married to Congressman Longworth, only had one daughter, Paulina. It wasn't Congressman Longworth's daughter. It was Senator Borah's daughter, as we know now. The other four children each had four children. And many of those grandchildren were quite prolific, so that I don't even have count of how many. There were 17 grandchildren. I would lose count if I tried the great-grandchildren. Not only has Ted the Fourth been so very kind at a National Game Wardens meeting on Lake Champlain, we had a nice half-hour visit, but here's some interesting news. Tweed Roosevelt, who comes to North Dakota, is the president of the Theodore Roosevelt Association. He himself, when I first started doing TR and I was introduced to him, everyone warned me, and Tweed let me know himself, he doesn't like people pretending to be his great-grandfather. This last week, we just announced with Tweed's leadership, I'm now officially endorsed by the Theodore Roosevelt Association for the quality and the content of my work. So the family greatly, I think, appreciates what I do and how I do it. And I'm trying to let them know that just because a fellow might not necessarily look the part or yet have the chops, it's still such a wonderful way to connect with audiences, and especially with young children that might not yet have the history bug or might not ever get the history bug. But for the fact that one day Teddy Roosevelt came to their classroom and told them stories about overcoming hardship and tragedy and perseverance and believing you can and you're halfway there. So I think we need more Teddy Roosevelts around this country.
Well, let's talk a bit about this kind of performance too, because as you mentioned, you might go into a classroom, you might be going to a trade show, you might be at the stage at Medora. How much of this is sort of a scripted or outlined routine, and how much of it is improvised?
I would say that I've got about 40 hours worth of stories, and I prayerfully think about what this audience needs today. Dale Carnegie, a great teacher in public speaking, always said your first question is, who's in the audience and why are they here? So the show for the fourth graders who are studying North Dakota history is a little bit different than the teachers' convention, who need to be inspired and reminded that the work that they're doing is amongst the most important work in the country. So that's what keeps it fresh for me. It's not rote. It's not memorized. It can be very extemporaneous and improv, but I really like as well before the show finding out where the audience members are from. Because if you're from Pennsylvania, I'm going to add 5 minutes of Pennsylvania stories to the show.
All right. Well, you keep researching as well. You were in Cuba, looked at the San Juan Hill area, didn't you?
How very moving to be in Cuba, at Santiago de Cuba, in the San Juan Heights, and to hear the misinformation being given out by the government guides in Cuba. But Cuba Libre was not just the rallying cry in 1898. I do believe that what we're witnessing is a rebirth of freedom, an investment and an energizing of the economy. I think you're going to see a closer relationship between the American people and the Cuban people, and maybe a greater presence for those of us that reenact Theodore Roosevelt down in Cuba. But for me, I've had to climb Mount Katahdin in Maine. I had to climb Mount Marcy in New York. I had to sleep a night on the grounds at the Elkhorn Ranch. There are these things that, as you know, as a performer, you want to feel them. You want to touch them. You want to know what sage smells like in the morning wind in the Badlands. So I still have so much more to learn.
And so much to give yet, too, because, again, this is your career now.
I love it. I wouldn't trade it for the world. I do say it saved me from a career in Illinois Republican politics. And yet I do think maybe I'm helping the country more by bringing Teddy Roosevelt to life. And as you know, whether those modern issues are of race relations or income disparity or labor and management, the role of the United States on the world stage, our issues that we debate today are the issues that were debated and not resolved, but hopefully improved by the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt.
Joe Wiegand is a Theodore Roosevelt repriser. He'll be appearing this summer at Medora, and of course it's a big show, and Joe is a big part of it. You can find out more about what he does at TeddyRooseveltShow.com. Joe, thanks for being with us today.
Doug, thank you, and thank you to everyone who supports Prairie Public Radio.
Coming up, more Main Street. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Agriculture Department is preparing to take over grain elevator licensing and inspection from the Public Service Commission. The 2019 legislature passed the measure to make that transfer. Ag Commissioner Doug Goring says his office is working on the transition.
And that means visiting with PSC, starting to fully understand what's going to have to all move. It also means that we're planning to start hiring in the near future.
Goring says his office will have to hit the ground running later this year when the transfer becomes effective. And he says he will be working with South Dakota's Ag Department, which has grain inspections in its portfolio. Goring says in many ways, South Dakota mirrors North Dakota.
the types of elevators, the brokers that are out there, the buyers, and try to make sure that we're covering everything correctly.
Goring also says he plans to spend some time with the industry, including producers, elevators, roving grain buyers, and brokers.
Get a really good idea of what the rules look like they have to be written for and how they're going to best serve everybody's interest and provide the best protection we possibly can.
Goring says he thinks the program will be a good fit.
Given the fact that 38 states have a grain inspection program and 34 of them exist in the Ag Department, I think we can do this.
According to a recent study, North Dakota has the fifth smallest drug problem in the country. The study was completed by WalletHub, a personal finance website. It compared each state against several different factors, including arrest and overdose rates, as well as opioid prescriptions and drug testing laws. Jill Gonzalez is an analyst for WalletHub. She says North Dakota ranked toward the bottom when it came to teenagers and adults using illicit drugs. She also says the state ranks toward the bottom in opioid prescriptions and deaths by drug overdose. One thing she said North Dakota could improve on was its laws and tools for law enforcement to better combat the issue.
North Dakota could definitely improve the most in terms of law enforcement. Right now, it does not have prescription drug monitoring laws. We're looking for states that have a prescription drug monitoring law that requires doctors to consult an opioid prescription database before prescribing them. So that's what North Dakota should be working toward.
Gonzalez also says North Dakota ranked last for the amount of drug treatment facilities per 100,000 people using illicit drugs. And the Greater Grand Forks Convention and Visitors Bureau will launch a social media campaign this week in an effort to attract more Canadian visitors to the city. The effort involves a gift card giveaway to the first 20 visitors who show up at the CVB office starting on Friday. Director Julie Riggs says one requirement is proof of stay in Grand Forks for at least one night.
Obviously, with the Canadian exchange rate, that's been not in our favor of recent years. And so we're really trying to show our appreciation for the Canadians that are still coming. We hear that they enjoy coming to Greater Grand Forks.
The gift cards carry a $100 value, and Riggs says other giveaway events are being planned throughout the year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. North Dakota is a unique place to live. It is unique because we have oil, we have wind, we have coal, we will potentially have other forms of energy. Plus, we have a very big dependence on agriculture. It truly is a fascinating state to cover. It is a challenge to tell news on a statewide news network because we're always looking for stories that might be interesting to listeners in Wahpeton and Williston, Bisbee to Bowman. And we have to choose that. Red River Valley News will interest people in Bismarck because the Red River Valley is the population center, and with the proposal to bring Missouri River water to Fargo, there are a lot of things that tie our state together. And that's what it's all about. Why should listeners get their statewide news from Prairie Public? It's because we endeavor to tell as many sides of the story as we can. We also endeavor to do what Charles Osgood once said was the challenge of broadcast news, and that's making the important story interesting and the interesting story important. Listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Each month, a group called Food of the North holds a public discussion about topics around food at Theater B in Moorhead called First Fridays at B. This month, three presenters spoke about gardening, and we're going to share some of their comments to that First Fridays at B audience today. First, horticulturist Don Kinsler offered tips for boosting vegetable production.
Now, I do a program that I call the Great Tomato Race. You know, it's fun to do vegetable gardening, and it's also fun to see how quickly you can start enjoying those vegetables, isn't it? So we're going to give a few tips today about how to get some of our vegetables to ripen quicker so we can start enjoying, you know, the fruits of our harvest. We can divide our garden vegetables into two broad categories. Now, one category are called cool season crops. Now, those are crops that we could actually have started planting out in our gardens in late April or through the first half of May. Now, in those cool season crops are fun things like peas, radishes, lettuce, spinach, kale. Those are items that can actually tolerate some very cool temperatures. They can even tolerate the frosty days that we've had, the frosty nights. So those can be started fairly early, cool season crops. So that is fun to get those growing. Now, not only can they tolerate very cool daytime air temperatures and frosty nights, but they also thrive in very cool soil. They love the coolness. In fact, if you've ever grown peas, peas in the heat of the summer can start to run out, can't they? So the other broad category of garden vegetables are called the warm season crops. Now, the warm season crops, the reason we call them warm season is because they require warm air temperatures. They're easily killed by frosts. So we usually wait with those for planting until the middle to the end of May, when chances of frost are less. Also, kind of interesting, we oftentimes think of air temperatures. We don't want our warm season crops to get frosted. And, of course, in that category are things like tomatoes and peppers, squash, cucumber, melons. And we're very sensitive so that they don't get frosted, by our late May, mid to late May frosts. But there's another fascinating thing about the warm season crops, and that is they will not begin growing until the soil temperature warms. So even if we don't get frost, the warm season crops won't begin root growth until the soil temperature warms to about 55 to almost 60 degrees. For example, you could take a tomato plant and plant it out into the garden. And even if you don't get air temperature frosts, that tomato plant will just sit there in cold soil until the soil warms up. And so interesting. In fact, if it sits in cold soil, these warm season crops, they will actually start to deteriorate. So we're going to talk about a couple of easy things we can do to get the soil to warm up. Now, to get the soil to warm up to that threshold that warm season crops love, we can use plastic. Now, plastic could be put out even the first part of May. Plastic could be laid out on the garden soil, and that will help to warm it up. See, if we put that out on the first part of May, and then middle to the end of May, plant out your warm season crops, they will be going into a nice warm soil. Now, what type of plastic would be best to use? Do we use black plastic or clear plastic? Now, a person might think black, but black plastic will absorb the sun's rays nicely on the surface. So if you put your hand on the surface, it would be warm. But if you slide your hand under the black plastic, the soil is cool. So the best plastic to use is clear, which gives a kind of a solar radiation. Now, notice the tomato plant, how it's the plastic has been laid out on the soil with the edges weighted down, and then the tomato plant planted into that. And that will get the tomato plant off growing well. And plants that are planted into plastic like this will oftentimes start bearing 2 to 3 weeks earlier than others. The clear plastic is left on throughout the garden season. Okay, so we've got clear plastic that works very well on the warm season crops. Now, many of us also use mulch of other types in our garden. For example, tomato plants grow very nicely with a layer of straw or dried grass clippings. An interesting point is that if you do put mulch in your garden on these warm season crops, other than the plastic type, it's very important to wait with that mulch until the soil has warmed up. We in our own garden like to put straw out, and the straw mulch or dried grass clippings should not be put out until late June. Straw or grass clippings will keep the soil actually quite cool. And so we want to let the soil warm up first. So we could do a clear plastic mulch, or if you don't get that done and you want to mulch the plants, then wait until the end of June to do that. One of my favorite crops to grow throughout my whole life has been watermelon. That is fascinating. It's a challenge. But by using the clear plastic mulch, we can get watermelons to ripen 2 to 3 weeks earlier. And if we can have a watermelon that ripens in August instead of September, I tell you, this watermelon, which was a variety called Sweet Dakota Rose, developed at Fullerton, North Dakota, wonderful. Just juicy, sweet, much better than one you could buy in the grocery store. So, again, an excellent way to ripen up quicker these warm season type vegetables is the use of clear plastic mulch. Thank you.
That was horticulturist Don Kinsler speaking at a recent First Fridays at B event at Theater B in Moorhead. They were talking about gardening, and another speaker about gardening was Jeffrey Miller with the Cass County Soil Conservation District. He explained the benefits of a fabric garden.
As a young child, I lived to be outside on my parents' small farm in Minnesota. It was a typical farm for the time with row crops, hogs, sheep, and chickens. There was also some forest land where I would spend untold hours exploring and hunting. Being involved in the daily workings of the natural world ignited a fire within me, and growing our own vegetables and livestock for the table, we were immersed in the food chain. As I grew older and moved away, I have come to realize that a lot of people are not immersed in the food chain. Many people have no idea where their food comes from. And you don't have to live on a farm or a ranch to take an active role in food production. Whether you live in a tiny apartment or a 10,000-acre farm, you can be a participant in the food web. An excellent way to be a participant in the food web is gardening. Gardening is fun. Gardening is also a lot of work. At various times in my life, I have had gardens up to a quarter of a football field in size. When the seed catalog starts showing up in the springtime, it's fun to order all kinds of them. And in the cool days of spring, it's fun to plant all kinds of seed. Unfortunately, that coolness goes away, and the long, warm, hot summer days deteriorate, and you're in a sultry, mosquito-infested survival test, trying to pull at least a few weeds before you're overtaken by the heat. Sometimes you get to the point where you just let it go, and the garden's taken over by pigweed, bindweed, lamb's quarters, and then all the other hundreds of weeds that overtake the raw earth. I've been there. But there's actually a technique that makes it a little bit easier, and it's called simply a fabric garden. At the Soil Conservation District, we often put down woven weed barrier fabric on our tree rows. You can also use that woven weed barrier fabric to make a time-efficient garden. It's just as simple as laying down the fabric over a freshly tilled garden and using fabric staples to hold it down. For transplants, you cut an X hole in the fabric and put your plant in. I'm a single father of three daughters, and fabric gardening is so simple that I often have them transplanting plants while I plant seeds. It's really a great way to expose children to growing their own food and the satisfaction that comes from doing the work themselves. I've always subscribed to the theory of more sunshine and less screen time for kids. So let's say that you've got your fabric garden planted and your crops are growing. All that's missing now is a buffet for the hardest working labor you have. My daughters would argue that they are the hardest working labor I have and that ice cream is needed to fuel their work. But actually, the hardest workers in our gardens are the pollinating insects. While the monarch butterfly is the poster child for pollinators, North Dakota has over 100 species of butterflies, over 1,000 species of moths, and hundreds of species of bees that work very hard to pollinate the crops that we grow. Unfortunately, the pickings are rather thin across the landscape, which is both a sad state of affairs for people that value biodiversity, as well as potential limiting factor for our crop yields. As with the fabric gardens, there are simple ways to provide this habitat. While a perennial planting of native grasses and flowers is the best option, to follow through on a crop rotation in a garden, annual plants can work. A prairie planter, which is simply a container garden with prairie grasses and forbs, can be planted and set near the margins of a small garden. For a larger garden, you can simply purchase the annual bee butterfly type mixes at the plant stores and plant one row or a border of your garden in flowers. This will give the insects plenty of food and cover to rest in while they work, as well as add a splash of beauty to your garden. Every human on earth is part of the food chain. Once the person goes through the effort to raise their own food, it helps to build the connection with the land. A person is also less likely to throw away food that they've raised themselves. With my own daughters, they're much less likely to throw away food that we raised or food that I harvested than food that we purchased in the grocery store. Working in the garden is also a wonderful way to connect with your family and friends. I have untold memories of working in the garden with my kids in the fresh air that I'll carry with me forever. Without the understanding of where our food comes from, it's quite easy to take it for granted.
Cass County Soil Conservation District's Jeffrey Miller talking about the benefits of a fabric garden at a recent First Fridays at B event at Theater B in Moorhead. The final speaker was Nola Storm, who shared stories from the Growing Together Community Garden Ministry and also offered tips for getting kids involved with gardening.
How many of you know that it was originally started because of mental health needs in our community, especially among our new American neighbors? You just thought we wanted to feed people, right? Well, we knew that there was a need, and we didn't know what to do about it. So we asked our congregation if there was something that we had a responsibility to do. And our congregation said, well, yes. But we didn't know what that was. We didn't know it was going to be a garden. But we talked about a garden, and then we said, well, okay, let's ask Jack, because he grows tomatoes. And if we were going to have a garden, would you be interested in? Jack said, yes. And so then we thought, well, we should probably talk to the New Americans to see if they were interested. So we did. And they said, yes. So I guess it just pays to ask. So then our garden was formed. We all know that gardening is good for you. You get exercise, you get vitamin D. And I like the idea that you get increased serotonin. You know, that's our little happiness neurotransmitter that our body has. Well, in the garden, we get a chance to work together, side by side with each other. And I just have a couple little short stories quick that I'll tell you about some of our gardeners. One of our gentlemen, his name is Bim, and he's an older gentleman, and he is originally from Bhutan. When Bhutan forced them out, he had to give up a really large farm and orchard that he had had for years. And then to top it all off, he's plunked down in the middle of North Dakota in the dead of winter. He was really sad. He was sad to the point that his family was really worried about him. So they scraped together enough money to send him down to Arizona for a week to stay with some relatives who had been settled there. After he came back, we invited him to go over to Jack's house and sow a few seeds in Jack's basement. Bim said something we couldn't understand, and his daughter translated for us. He says he's finally happy here. And then there was another gentleman that was involved with us. His name was Hassan. He was a single man living alone in an apartment. He has diabetes and high blood pressure. And one day he's working at the garden. He says, you know, without the garden, I'd just be sitting at home alone in my apartment. But here I'm getting exercise, I'm getting healthy food, and I'm with my friends. So I really thought that is really an amazing story to me that shows about what the health benefits of garden are, not just physical health, but mental health too. So each week we show up, we pitch in, we work side by side. Everybody gets to works for their share. The time that you spend, that's your share. We have buckets of soil. People get to pitch in, carry the soil. We have plants that people have helped to nurture, to seed, to transplant, and then to bring into the ground. We really like the fact that families can show up, bring their kids, be involved, bring your grandkids. You can work side by side. Kids that grow their food, they're more likely to eat the food that they grow. They're more likely to value the food that they grow. And plus, they're outside. They're away from the screens. They're out of apartments. So many of our gardeners are apartment dwellers, so they don't have access to a green space. But they can show up here, and they can have a green space. In fact, a couple of our gardeners here, we work with a children's garden that's specifically for the kids to show up and learn about the things that they can do to grow their own food. Kids can haul wheelbarrows, they can water, they can pick things. Kids are especially great at picking cucumbers because it really pays to be low to the ground. We had one little guy. He was so good at it because I could go through the whole row and I'd think I did awesome. And then he'd go, you missed one. And I go, why? I was just there. How did you know? Well, I stare at him. That's the way I find him. We also know that adding fun things into the gardens really get kids excited and involved. Although, let me tell you, adults really love these things too. We've added tunnels, vining tunnels, to several of our gardens so that we can grow really kind of interesting and fun things that will grow up, like small varieties of squash, different kinds of gourds, especially snake gourds, because some of our families like to grow snake gourds. And they get super long. We grow yard-long beans or scarlet runner beans, different kinds of beans, things that will hang down. And then you go underneath, and it's just like this fairy tale area of things hanging over your head. Kids love to go in there and hang out. And the adults like to go in there and hang out, too. So my suggestion would be, if you want to get your kids gardening at home, get them their own containers. Do something like, you don't have to do anything as fancy as a tunnel, but you can get an archway sometimes at a garden store, or you can form a little teepee structure and let things grow up on the teepee, and kids can be involved in it. Also, a great way to get kids involved is, if you have kids that can read, they can take the seed package, and they can be the ones in charge of deciding how far apart things can be, how deep does it have to be planted. You can get rulers and measuring things. I have an example of one of our grids that we have that kids, so that things are going to be perfectly spaced. But get your kids involved in that. Let them grow things that kids like carrots, cherry tomatoes, little cucumbers, and fun things to eat like that. One of the benefits, one of this physical health and mental health, is just that thing that we can all hang out together. Periodically throughout the growing season, we will have a potluck. So that means we show up, we bring our food, we sit down together, we share our stories, we share our food. And to me, that's one of probably the best mental health benefits of the way we garden as a community of people, is that we develop that family, that relationship with each other. So if you're interested in being part of Growing Together, we're always happy to have more. I've got some business cards. But just realize that it's good for you, it's good for children, and it's good for the community when people get a chance to show up and work side by side together. Thank you very much for your time.
Nola Storm sharing stories from the Growing Together Community Garden Ministry. She spoke at First Fridays at B at Theater B in Moorhead recently, along with Jeffrey Miller with the Cass County Soil Conservation District and horticulturist Don Kinsler. First Friday at B events are held on the first Friday of the month, with coffee served at 7, with a one-hour program that begins at 8 a.m. First Fridays at B are free and open to the public. Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to present the live storytelling event, The Moth, November 14th at the Fargo Theater. Tickets available now at Tickets300 or online at jadepresents.com. Prairie Public is a listener-supported statewide radio network. We cover everywhere in North Dakota, from the Bakken to Bismarck, Wishick to West Fargo. But we wouldn't be able to bring you NPR News, news from the Prairie region, and all the great cultural and music programs you enjoy without the help of listeners like you. And so we would like to send a special thank you out to our sustaining members, whose generous monthly contributions keep Prairie Public's radio stations and online streams humming along with quality programs and independent, fact-based journalism. Thank you, sustainers. We simply can't do this without you.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 13th. On this date, in 1887, the McLean County Mail touted the great advantages that the town of Washburn had to offer. The town had been founded 5 years earlier, in 1882, by John Satterland. He felt the area was an excellent site for a town. The location offered many benefits, including good soil, an abundance of wood and coal, and excellent water transportation thanks to the Missouri River. Satterland's assessment proved correct, and steamboats began to regularly arrive from St. Louis. The boats brought groceries, farm tools, and other necessities. They exchanged the goods for buffalo hides, furs, and agricultural products. The river offered the best means of travel, and the steamboat Yellowstone was the first boat to ply the Missouri in 1832. In the heyday of steamboats, there were 40 of them on the Missouri, employing about 1,200 men. Washburn became a thriving town in just a few years. It billed itself as the grandest little city on the Missouri. It became the county seat of McLean County, and one of the biggest assets was a ferry. In 1887, it was the only ferry across the Missouri for 200 miles in either direction. The Missouri River had long presented an obstacle to westward expansion. Crossing it was a challenge. Channels and sandbars shifted, and there was no consistently safe route. In winter, the frozen river offered a natural highway, but the spring melt created dangers as the ice broke up. This resulted in both people and animals drowning. In 1805, Lewis and Clark found a number of dead buffalo that had fallen through the melting ice. The first bridge to cross the Missouri was the Northern Pacific Railroad Bridge at Bismarck. It was completed in 1883 and built 50 feet above the water to allow for steamboat traffic. Eventually, other bridges would make crossing the Missouri a routine task. The Missouri River is a notoriously unpredictable river. Sometimes it's slow and lazy. Sometimes it's a raging torrent that overflows its banks. The river has been channeled, dammed, and diverted, but portions still echo the wild river observed by Lewis and Clark in 1804 to 1806. And Washburn, by the way, just happens to be home to a Lewis and Clark interpretive center. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
On the next morning edition, are President Trump's sanctions against Cuba tough enough to change the government?
It just isn't going to have the political consequences that they hope that it will have.
Also, a new NPR podcast uncovers lies about a murder in Alabama in 1965.
I think they killed a man on the way to Birmingham.
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll talk with Greg Schwimm, a stand-up comedian with a new web series, A Comedian Crashes Your Pad, featuring interviews with Airbnb hosts. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer will begin a series of reports about the risks of pesticides for field workers. And we'll hear about the new Badlands Opera Project, which will have its inaugural performance Saturday at Dickinson State University. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.